You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Robert Olin Butler. He's the author, most recently, of The Deep Green Sea, previously Tabloid Dreams, They Whisper, A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize, and several novels before that. Now, the new book, The Deep Green Sea, continues many of the themes to be found in the Robert Olin Butler canon or corpus. And one of those is the obsession with an abandoned child or a missing child, a concern that has recurred both in the American and the Vietnamese novels. And it seems to me to be one of several obsessions that govern the ongoing work. I wondered if you would talk about that a bit.
Well, it's always good to interview with you, Michael, because you always pick up on some absolutely wonderful and valid motifs in the work that I hadn't given a lot of thought to, but you're absolutely correct about that. Then it goes back to On Distant Ground and beyond, some of the earlier novels as well. I don't know quite where it all came from. I'm a father of one son who's now out here in L.A. and working in the film business. And it was as a father, I found that sense of protectiveness and deep attention to the child as a very strong feeling in my life. I'm not slipping into the autobiographical fallacy here, but just it's a concern that got stoked deeply down into my unconscious where these books come from. And certainly that sense of things is in The Deep Green Sea, although with a very dark twist to it. The sense of also the unknown child, the thing left behind, has been something that I've worked out as well.
But I've been wondering because, you know, in two novels, for instance, by David Magouf, there is a wild child. One of these wild children, these feral children, is being brought up by all people of Ovid, but I wonder, are these mysterious creatures virtually versions of the author? Because it seems to me that of all the things that writers I know are obsessed by is the question of how could they have been the child they were meant to be, not the adult they were predicted to be, but what would have allowed them to have the childhood they needed to have that would have made it, of course, impossible for them to write.
Right.
A perfect childhood is a, you know, sure sign of someone who will not grow up to be a writer. But I wonder about that. Are these children's versions of a lost self?
Interesting. Although they, in my work, they carry the very problems that one would then impute to that lost childhood. The child that was not known to exist in On Distant Ground and even in The Deep Green Sea. The child under siege by a mother who had a terrible agenda for the child, as in They Whisper, for example. Just a few examples. So I think the impulse to be concerned about and cherish the child and find the child and rescue the child and protect the child may well come from that, but it's not. The alternate version of childhood, we have not, at least I haven't found my way through to a vision of the childhood that could have been.
Now, in this new novel by my guest Robert Olin Butler, The Deep Green Sea, a man, Ben, is going back to Vietnam. He goes to sit in a noodle house that used to be a bar that he frequented, where he had originally met a bar girl with whom years ago he had an affair, and there is a memory of things past quality. And as in a dream or a fairy tale, a woman approaches him when he's sitting at this noodle house. She cautions him that the dogs nearby are not the enchanted, friendly dogs of fairy tales, but a ferocious, wild dog. And they almost immediately fall in love. And what seems like a faded romance begins. This is a book that is poised on recurrence, not occurrence. And I wondered why.
The why comes from, I think, and I don't want it to sound political because it's, as you know, I'm not an overtly political writer at least, but that the sense of that something utterly crucial, and this is from Ben's point of view, the American's point of view going back, that something utterly crucial to the self, to the identity of the man, was left behind.
In Vietnam.
In Vietnam. I think that's a very common intuition for American veterans, even as they rail against, you know, or fear the memories of the war and rail against the forces that brought them there. The reality is that at that crucial moment in their life, plunged into a situation in which the cosmic questions were raised every moment of every day, and then plucked out again without a kind of closure. I think that there's, for many men who went there, there's a sense, and women too, a sense of some crucial part of the self left behind. And I think you can project that in large into the American psyche, that we left our innocence there, we left some important part of our national identity in that country. It's why there's such a tremendous emotionalism about reconnecting there and a fascination with it on many people's parts. So the return, and the return to the very place where he had the illusion, because he recognizes at age 20 there was, when he was there, it was not love, though they may have used the word, to return to the very place in which the illusion of connection had been, feeling that something had been left behind. And of course there's an incident in the book too of war, in which he has a startling and persistent vision of an American in Vietnam rendered incomplete. I mean, he sees a man who's lost an arm after a rocket attack, standing out in a rice paddy and looking at himself almost calmly, going as if he did not know where the rest of him had been. I think it's that sense. The drive, the why, is that we all have left something behind, and we are have been rendered incomplete because of it.
Well, it seems that the war novel itself involves always a kind of return. It's as if, whether it's James Jones or Norman Mailer, that there is a facet of that experience which needs to be returned to, particularly by a writer, as if this has been a kind of intensity that life doesn't match. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to say something perhaps wildly incorrect, because it seems to me that the way these writers think about war and return to that excitement has something of a repetition compulsion, something it seems in common with sexual addiction. The remaking of an initial excitement, the desire to be caught, the need to have a successful conquest, the need to rekindle an original excitement, the disappointment that it has not been as exciting, leading not to an end of the compulsion, but the trigger to a new episode. And since you've written about both, I wondered if you have any ideas about their connection.
Oh, man. It's an interesting thought. And I think that if you get down deep enough, I think there is probably a common ground. There's another experience of battle and of war, and it's one that you'll find in war novels. Now, I think in a way we take me out of the – we're talking about war novels in a way that I do not write them, which mm-hmm. is novels about the war, the direct battle experience. And that is the bonding that occurs between the participants in the war, that there is a deep and intimate connection within the platoon, within the small group of men who share the risk of their lives together and who bear the responsibility of protecting each other together. And that bonding, that intensity of bonding that occurs between those people, certainly I think at some deep level – speaks to the same yearning that human beings have to connect sexually. You know, all of them go back to that fundamental universal human pattern of being desperately concerned that, contrary to parents' circumstances, we are all, each of us individually, utterly alone on planet Earth, you know, and that we need to somehow break through from the personal isolation that we feel into some connection with the other. And we do that in sex, and we do that in the foxhole as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're one of the very few writers for whom, at least in the writing experience, Vietnam is not presented as a personal nightmare. I believe you were, by and large, a translator there, yes?
Right.
And the presentation in these books by Robert Olin Butler is of Vietnam as a woman who is being loved, her language is being learned, her folklore is being learned, she's being explored. It's as if the military experience is to the side, really.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This is a Vietnam of bar girls and peasants and being invited in, whether that's invited into a family or invited into a foreign body or invited into the body of the land. And so there's a very strange tone. You don't go to Robert Olin Butler for the normal kind of war book. Mm-hmm. And yet there is here the same phenomenon of obsessive-compulsive return.
Yes, I think that's an accurate observation, and there is an obsession to the return. Though it becomes a kind of meta obsession in a sense, because there is an implicit obsession in the combat novel, where the author has dealt with an experience that clearly came out of his direct experience. Of his encounter with war, and so the obsession is one level back, you know, at the author level. Mm-hmm. I've got to write this war story. You think of Larry Heineman's work. You think of Tim O'Brien's work. His bruised chest from pounding it, and so forth. And you know those, and they have an intense obsession to return to it on their own level, but the work itself is not about return. The work itself is about the experience of the war and of the of battle. In my books, I think there is in fact obsession. Return obsession is indeed the subject itself. I am returning obsessively to it, but so indeed are the characters within the work.
Well, in general, I'd say, in Tim O'Brien, for instance, the writer-soldier is like the infected splinter that needs to be removed from the place they are. So the book is a catharsis, but it's a catharsis of the self from the experience, not the experience from the self. In your work, it's very different. It's as if, you know, the narrator's figuratively is the sperm, Vietnam is the egg, and there's the repeated desire to reach its center and to generate a child. The child can be the book, but the child is more likely this mystery child we were speaking of before, who is being sought time and time again. Did I leave someone or something behind? And that's, in a sense, the state from which this book starts. Now, this is the most improbable book in the world, in a sense, The Deep Green Sea.
Yes, it is.
In that it says, okay, what are the chances of a sperm impregnating an egg? I don't know, in fact, statistically what they are, but they're small. We know this to be the case, infinitesimally small. What is the chance of a man having had a child he didn't know he had, going back to Vietnam to find someone who turns out, in fact, to be the grown-up daughter, to lapse immediately into a charmed and becalmed love affair with her without knowing.
I say prior to her, to that knowledge.
Yes. To begin to be filled with the imagination of the possibility that this is his child, and then to have it not be merely a morbid or paranoid fantasy, but to turn out, in fact, to be the case. Now, what made you want, clearly this was a decision, to write the novel of the nearly impossible event and have every link in its chain be accurately forged?
I think it comes out of my intense interest in folklore and mythology. This is not a – I mean, there's a – the book is about real human beings. And if you go back, it's really akin in that way to Tabloid Dreams, where you take the improbable mythological surface – and yet find the richly developed, full-blooded characters within them. It's that it's that wedding of pop culture and mythology and folklore with the impassioned and fully developed human characters.
Well, in fact, in the book, they make love twice, I believe. And the soldier each time, Ben, the ex-soldier, experiences a kind of necessary withdrawal. And he's filled with dreads and fantasies about who this woman is. This woman, in fact, has in her apartment a shrine to the GI father she has never known. She doesn't pray to her mother, whom it turns out is, in fact, unbeknownst to her, alive. And so the two have always been in conversation with each other, he in his nightmares, she at her shrine. So their coming together is a mere fact compared to the continuous dialogue they've been having. Now, that on the one hand. On the other hand, there is the fear in reading this book that this is merely a surprise, a horrific joke being played by fate on two people, or a not fully examined incest fantasy that, if fully examined, would be simply horrifying. That the book is structured to avoid having to look very closely at the consequences for both a man and a woman, both a parent and a child, of incest. The book sidesteps the need to view these things with horror. And I wonder again why.
Well, I think that the tragedy of it is not in the relationship itself. I mean, that is to come together as adults, never having known a father-daughter relationship, never having had the power structure of that relationship, or the genetic, taboo felt at all. Both characters have never had a connected relationship in their life. And so the book is not intended to explore the nature of incest. It's exploring the nature of connection and the kinship of souls and bodies and how that's expressed. And the tragedy of it is that this other fear and it's about self-deception as well, and the consequences of hasty expression of the physical self. I mean, that's where the focus is. Those are the things that I explore. The consequences of incest in this story. It is the consequences that involve power relationships, consciousness of relationship, and so forth don't apply. And so I'm not. It's not a book to explore incest. It's to explore
exactly.
The love and connection. That's right.
I'm not claiming that the book has left out something it needs to explore.
No, I understand.
But rather that it has chosen to explore something that obviates what would otherwise be a very unbearable and dark and, my understanding, incest of this sort would leave its participants absolutely broken.
Right.
At the point where their conversation would begin about this, one throws himself off a cliff.
Right.
This is not Oedipus stabbing his eyes out. This is making the story unavailable to vocalization.
Right, that's right. Because the taboo still applies. I mean, it is deeply felt, and the self-deception. It's a book about self-deception too, and when that is clear, then it must end one way or the other. The interesting thing, I think, is that Tien then, the consequence for Tien is even though she carries to term and has as her daughter now her father's child, the thing that rescues her again is the folklore, is the myth of it.
Mm-hmm.
She returns to her shrine. She conducts the jasmine flower ritual on her child, and in a sense she accepts as the dragon and princess myth, which runs through the book, does. She accepts the fact that this is an extraordinary event that meant to produce something beautiful. Just as Vietnam was produced out of incest, according to the myth. And by the way, the Western creation myth implies incest as well.
In A Good Scent from a Strange Mountain, there's a fairly consistent alternation in stories between stories told by Buddhists and stories told by Catholics. This is a similar kind of alternation. The strains of acceptance and responsibility seem to alternate in chapters and alternate within the characters themselves. Ben is a character who feels guilt but who is part of the river of return.
Mm-hmm.
Tien is a character who was raised Catholic but has the impulse toward ancestor worship and Buddhist practice. And I wanted to end by asking you about those strains in your fiction.
I think that I think again that you're right that those polarities exist. I think because for me the religions are just a further kind of mythical elaboration of views of the universe. I mean, I say mythical, but I take myth very seriously, and I take seriously the truth of myth, that myths are ways in which they're common humanities novels, as it were. These are the things that are dramatic renderings of situations and people and characters and circumstances that we feel resonate into some universal truth. And so the Buddhist and the Catholic alternation of perspective for me is like alternating the dragon myth with the jasmine flower or the tale of your father's near death and his in a steel mill as a youth.
The myth of the hero.
The myth of the hero. Yeah, I think that the alternating of a religious perspective fits in that way.
Do you feel that alternation from novel to novel? These books, in a way, seem tidal in the way they're pulled in one direction and another.
Yes, indeed. And indeed, my next novel, which I'm just now beginning to write, returns to the tabloid world. In fact, if you remember Desi and his UFO and Edna Bradshaw in the trailer camp in Help Me Find My Spaceman Lover, they are central figures in my next novel. So there does feel to me, too, that there's now, two polarities like the horseshoe magnet, that the polarities have come very near to each other and exist in a kind of force field down there. So that to be honest with you, looking past this next novel, which I'm not certain that I don't feel yet another Vietnam book. I may have said this before, maybe even to you, that I feel like the use of Vietnam as central metaphor in my work may now fade significantly, and I have that feeling again now. But certainly up to this point, indeed, you're prescient heading toward the next novel. That title shift is happening again.
I've been speaking to Robert Olin Butler, the author most recently of The Deep Green Sea, published by Henry Holt. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Michael, always.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.